Us into our conversation today. That's Sonny Stitt with Sonny's book. Sonny Stitt on alto and tenor sax. Booker Irvin also on tenor sax. We just heard a little bit of him. Don Patterson on organ and Billy James on drums. Would you believe that was recorded in 1964? I'll talk like the old folks. That was recorded in 1964. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead, and it is Friday, March the 29th, and we are holding on to our topic of education, looking at many aspects of it, because there is going to be a revelation, I believe, at the end of it all. And we've worked on coming up with a definition.
BRICS leaders arrived in Durban.
Oh, I'm hearing something in my ears. Okay. We defined education. We had, I think, a pretty decent idea of what it was, what it is, and what it is supposed to do. We talked a bit about the purpose of it. And now we want to talk about how it became a formalized thing in our society, in our experience. How did that happen? So that was the homework assignment. If you've completed your assignment, and even if you haven't, but you have a very good idea, 888-874-4888 is the number to call. 888-874-4888. Why are we talking about education? And why are we approaching it in this way, in a kind of unstructured way, although we have an idea in mind as to where we are going? Because it is meant for us to just stop a little bit. Let's just stop a minute and think about this thing that we take for granted, or we take for granted the idea that we know what it is. And then when we are forced to stop and think about it, then we see a line, a logical line, that tells us in so many ways that our expectations are a little off the mark. And there's a reason to understand why. There's a reason for it. But nonetheless, we now have to ask ourselves, knowing what we know, and we have established, I mean, even in our casual discussion, we are aware of certain things, and yet we believe otherwise, especially of the role of government. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is accounting for the dissonance? We know certain things, and they are incontrovertible. We have the facts, they are established, we know what is happening in many instances. So why do we have a different view about education? And by a different view, I mean a different attitude about it. We have different expectations about it. And we operate on the basis of those expectations. When the very expectations simply do not line up with the facts. So this is where we're going. You would want to think that if you know something, and if you have some definitive proof, enough at least to convince you that you ought to be thinking a different way, then why do we think otherwise? But let's return to this assignment today. And we now take a look at the role of government. How did government get involved in this thing? And why is it so formalized? Why the need to formalize education? And in formalizing education, what actually came out of it? What happened on the consumer side, for lack of a better term, as opposed to the governmental side, the side that made decisions? Who's going to be up first? 888-874-4888. I've given you several clues already, and I didn't mean to be that kind. I wanted to make you suffer through it. Yes, let's flesh this thing out little by little. A little pain doesn't hurt every now and then to think really hard as to why is it, why do we do this? Why do we think differently? And there's a psychological question, but we're dealing right now with education, so I might as well throw that in the pot. We think differently from what the facts suggest. So inform me, inform us all, throw some ideas out into the pot, put it in the pot. Let's see what we can draw from for discussion today. While you're doing that, let me just let you know that I really am so pleased with the responses I'm getting about the program. I'm glad that you find it useful, valuable, that it encourages you to think. I'm glad that you are participating at the level that you are, because that's great. That's what this is all about. There's no business about whether you're right or wrong. I don't come at you from that perspective. I've never really liked that perspective. I like the idea that you're thinking, and it's sufficient to be thinking. And little by little, you hone your skills at thinking. And in doing so, you begin to connect the dots. You begin to make sense of your own environment by yourself. As an immigrant, I had to do it. And as an immigrant coming from a colonial society, it was double duty. Very often, I think we need a special kind of program, a de-stressing program, or some kind of program to get people stripped of their colonial past and get them ready to deal with the American present. And sometimes you wonder, gee, which is better or which is worse? Coming from a colonial society is an education in itself, if you're lucky enough to hold on to a couple of your brain cells. Because, and this is a very interesting difference, I think, between the way America reaches out and expresses its power abroad and the way, say, the British or the Europeans do generally. Of course, when it was said that Britain, the sun never shines on the British Empire, especially in the days of Queen Victoria, you have to say to yourself, now, I mean, just on a basis of logic, it's a little island, to Britain, how is it possible that the sun couldn't shine, means couldn't set on the British Empire? The holdings of Britain were so vast, global, continents and subcontinents under the rule of the British. They certainly did not have the manpower to militarily maintain the conquests. But what they did, and what they were very adept at, was designing satellite societies, mimicking their own social order. And so the approach with the British might have been initially militarily so, but the main task, the main thing that they refined was the conquest of the mind, of the psyche, so that they set up all these artificial societies, all predicated on their own so-called structures, with a little tweak here and a little tweak there. So you would be in India, and I'll give you the case of Mahatma Gandhi, a perfect example of a colonial subject. Here's a guy, he's a lawyer, very well trained, by the way, in Britain as well. But initially, Mahatma Gandhi saw himself as a product of privilege, which is exactly the way he was groomed to think. Saw his own people in that hierarchical sense, the way the British did. He was, in fact, an Indian man seeing the world through British eyes, which is why he could go to South Africa and adopt initially the same racist attitudes as the Boers, the settlers of South Africa. So his education was complete, and he had to work and work and work very hard against it in order to arrive at a sense of justice and logic in his own head, because he had been, in effect, a kind of zombie. He looked like an Indian, but he was not Indian. This is replicated all around the world. In Trinidad, where I was born and raised, we were all indoctrinated. There were Trinidadians who were very proud to be more British than the British, and spent almost an entire lifetime as schizophrenics. You know, we lived in a world where we have mangoes. We are taught to make shepherd's pie. We're the land of steel band and calypso. But we're learning by yon bonny bank and by yon bonny brae, where the sun shines bright on Loch Lomond. We are educated, but not about our culture. Why? Because the predetermined design was that we were to fit into the pegs were already set. I mean, we were already planned for. The British certainly did not have in mind that its colonies would, in one way or the other, undo its influence. They didn't have that in mind. But even after independence was achieved, we still had the phenomenon. I mean, Trinidad and Jamaica, for example, just celebrated 50 years of, quote, independence, unquote. And yet there's still the phenomenon of crown lands. The Queen still owns choice pieces of land in our countries. And in many colonies which are now independent, her face is still on their currency. the court, the highest court, is in London. So you see how these things happen, and you are educated to accept your second-class citizenship. You accept it to accept it, not only to accept it, but to rejoice and be happy about it, because you have been elevated by being conquered by the Europeans. Believe it or not, the same experience happened here in the United States. Same experience. We had people who came here for all kinds of reasons, but the one thing they had in common was that they were the rejects, for the most part, of Britain. They didn't want them there. And came to the United States with a plan, knowing even before they set foot on solid ground that they were going to dominate. They were going to take over this place. They were going to claim it as their own. And, of course, make sure that it reflects their superior cultural, political, and religious beliefs. They knew that. And even as I'm traveling quickly, but even as the Constitution was written, the last thing these folks ever intended was that it would be a democracy, that nobody wanted democracy. If you are a conqueror, why would you be expected, or why would anybody expect you to want democracy? They don't go together. Conquest and parity are absolute antitheses of each other. It's just logical. Somebody who conquers you would never, ever want you to be on the same footing. Now, then what is the point of conquest? The point of conquest is subjugation, annihilation, absolute control. There is only going to be one winner, because if you have two, then a conquest has not occurred. You have to have one winner. And in the case of the United States, the conquerors actually borrowed the idea of government from the people they conquered, because it did not exist where it came from. They borrowed the concept of, quote, democracy, unquote, but they borrowed it. That is to say, they stole it, because it had been unlike anything they had seen before or experienced before. They came from an experience of royalty and monarchical rule, and, you know, the king was always right, which is why they ended up being expelled in the first place. But theirs was not a democratic experience, so they were not willing to extend that to anybody else, especially not, certainly not the people that they conquered. So something else had to be fashioned, because inevitably you have to have rules, right? You've got to have rules. They did not want to be kings, because that would leave a very bad taste in people's mouths. They've just come from a land in which they were opposed to the rule of the royalty, the rule of the monarch. So they didn't want to duplicate that. But by the time they got to the business of deciding what, quote, government would be, they had been exposed to the, what was then called the Iroquois Confederacy, which is the major the amalgamation of the largest of the indigenous nations and how they conducted their government. And they borrowed liberally from it. So the U.S. Constitution kind of mirrors that form of self-governance. But then again, you still had the issue of how do you, as a finite group of people who clearly are conquerors, and that's not a good word, how do you maintain control? You set up, quote, laws that you can enforce, because if you create the law, you can also create the form of enforcement to it. And you use your skills, your brain power, to strategize ways in which you control. You control things. And of course, when these 13 states, which were 13 separate countries practically, decided, well, we don't know if we want to be part of that. And they said, well, listen, let's talk logic here. You know you are part of us, the conquering settler group. You know that we are always going to be threatened with war from the people we conquered. They're not going to take this lying down. So one of the things, one of the benefits that would accrue is that if we came together and we pooled our resources, we could mount a unified defense or even an offense if we have to. And that's a really good, compelling argument for coming together. And they said, oh, you know, that's kind of right. And if we come together, you know, we don't have to trade with them. We can build our own roads and our highways, and it will increase trade, and we begin to build our resources. We don't have to even use them. We have a system, you know, we could import our labor. you know that slavery, right? Okay. We could get the people we need. And for all kinds of purposes, it's a good idea to go get them. Because now that would help us build an economy, and it gives us bodies to help us defend ourselves if we have to. And as a small group of people, we will loom large on the international level because we are now going to be the masters of our own industry. And we will even own the means of production, that is slaves. We'll own them. And we can fashion a really good life here. We can make things nice for ourselves. So why don't we kind of band together? They would have you believe that the issue was slavery and whether the North, which was leading toward industrialism, and the South, which was leading towards the agricultural sector, that was essentially the rift. And it wasn't, really. It was also about the fact that they had what brought them eventually together was they did not like democracy. They didn't want it. They were actually opposed to it. Because they were the new hierarchy, and you now have to fashion something to reflect your newfound power. It kind of grated against their nerve a bit because they understood the contradiction, but they had to put something down on paper, even if they didn't mean it. So all that talk about all men are created equal and all of that stuff, all that wonderful fine language, even as they wrote it, they knew it to be a contradiction. They were slaveholders, many of them. Even in the North, the progressive North was one of the largest processing points, transshipment points for slaves. But they all had whiteness, quote unquote, in common. That is to say, automatic superiority. And while they may not have been of the nobility back in the old country, they had a historical memory of being better than whoever it is they met when they came here. So they were the new elite. You fashion laws as the power that exists. You fashion laws and means to maintain your position of privilege and authority. And what is the point of getting together? Well, the point of getting together is there is unity, where there's strength in unity. And we can now declare ourselves without screaming it. There's no word white in anywhere in the Constitution. In fact, the word democracy does not appear in the Constitution at all. The word just never appears. It is not there. If you're looking for it, you won't find it. But they wanted and they had to regulate this new society in such a way that it still yielded them the benefits. They still were the power. They still were in charge. But they would make it feel less than the line of demarcation that they left behind. But by this time, where the Constitution is written, several generations after their so-called forefathers had landed at Jamestown, the historical memory was strong still as to who they were, and more importantly, who they were not. And that's a very important cautionary tale in the United States that I had to learn. It is not important to decide who you are. It is extremely important to know who you are not. So education became a very valuable thing as time went on. It wasn't important in the early days because it was an agricultural society in the beginning, pretty much, that was evolving with a huge number of internal contradictions. But there came a time in this evolution when it became clear, you need newer and newer blood, and you need oxygenated blood. You don't need blood that was anemic, because the issue was nation building. You need to have capable people involved in nation building. The question of labor was settled a long time ago. That's called slavery and indentureship. The issue is who is going to rule and how do you maintain order and how do you maintain privilege? How do you maintain white supremacy? Education is a great way to do it. So you fashion a system initially on who should know. We talked about education as a process of moving from the state of not knowing or the state of no knowledge or little knowledge into more knowledge or just knowledge. You select those people, which is what the British always did. They would go, for example, into India and make a leader, give him a title, a new title, a guy who was, let's say, who in charge of a vast expanse of land almost as big as Britain itself. They'll say, you know what, we're going to make you a governor general. And he would jump for joy. You really mean that? You mean I could be a governor general? Sure, here's a little, we give you a star. You could pin this on your chest. you'll be the governor general. And believe it or not, that alone was sufficient for many Indian leaders to engage in mass slaughter of their own people in service to the British, just to demonstrate how loyal he was. Very big psychological thing to do. But that is how Britain basically was able to exert control without themselves having to share the same spaces as in South Africa, where the settlers and the people that they dominated shared the same landmass. Britain was still Britain. Control center was still in Britain. But all of their assets were operating in fairly good shape, considering how devastating it should have been for the British. The fact that they succeeded at all speaks to the validity of this idea of psychological manipulation. Hello, Neil from New York. How are you doing? Hello? Is Neil with us? Oh, he dropped. Please call back. Apparently your line dropped, Neil. But this is how it is done. You shape laws that appear to be a benefit, and in some cases really are a benefit, because from time to time there is a legitimate need. You do need to give up something in order to get what you want. For example, for previously enslaved people, which is where Lincoln was, you needed to give up something to get what you want. So you work out an emancipation proclamation. Just as an example, to give slaves their freedom, but you get what you want, which is a nation. But you still had the upper hand in deciding would they ultimately get freedom or not, or would they get freedom in name only, or would they get the kind of freedom that is constantly legislated and is up for review and that could be revoked at any time. It's the genius of governing. So you give people education, and you commit as a nation, one of the leading nations of the world, for example, you sign on to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, where all the world's leading nations, suddenly interested in the future and in the civil rights and human rights of all who lived within their borders, all such lofty ideas. And then you see, let me read you Article 26 of the Declaration. It actually has three sections to it. Section 1, everyone has the right to education. Education shall be free, at least in the elementary and fundamental stages. Elementary education shall be compulsory. Technical and professional education shall be made generally available, and higher education shall be equally accessible to all on the basis of merit. Section 2. Education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality and to the strengthening of respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. It shall promote understanding, tolerance, and friendship among all nations, racial or religious groups, and shall further the activities of the United Nations for the maintenance of peace. And Section 3, parents have a prior right to choose the kind of education that shall be given to their children. Now, that's the most recent piece of historical reference as to why there came a time to formalize a government's commitment, this government's commitment, and many governments' commitments to education, at least elementary and high school. They kind of went there. So you formalize an educational process, but leading up to all of that, you know all the stories about lack of access to quality education, lack of access to education, period. And merit, the small word that developed there, well, a lot was done in the name of merit because there were so many studies showing that only whites actually had what it took to be educated. And not just all whites either. Poor whites, well, you could exempt them because they were the same as blacks. They suffered the same. But certain classes out of which you can get certain kinds of performance and certain kinds of labor, yes, it's a good idea to invest in them. So you devise an educational system that appears to be giving, I mean, in line with this Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And at the same time, you cut out the legs from under it because you still must maintain a racially bifurcated society. It is important. It is important to maintain that because that was, in fact, the predicate object, the ultimate aim of the formation of the country. It was meant to be of benefit, but not to certain people. So even as you commit, you don't quite commit. Or even as you commit in such a way that you have options that nobody else could exercise but you. And if you commit to a thing in such a way that you actually do live out the spirit and the letter and the word of that commitment, you stand the chance of upending the privileges that the folks have enjoyed so long, and they don't want to be on par with anybody else. It's not a thing that everybody should enjoy. Democracy is not, as I said, it's not in the Constitution. It just was not a concept for the Constitution, no matter how much people talk about it. The word is not there. I dare you to find it. So we begin to see this as a backdrop, and that now causes you to ask the question, given, and I've just, you know, I went from 0 to 80 pretty fast because I thought, you know, we would have had a very protracted discussion today, telephone-wise, but maybe you're listening more than you want to talk. But in that fast overview, what I'm pointing to is that governments, this government, makes, like many governments, makes a commitment to something. They don't particularly mean it. But they make the commitment because it is the right and politically advantageous thing to do. And in any event, they have the wherewithal to backpedal from it and legally succeed at doing so because they own the apparatus of government. They own the courts and whatnot. They can prevail more often than you do, or that you can. But education, this grooming of a labor force, this grooming of an educated citizenry, if we understood and truly understood the history of the development of the country, what was behind it, and the nucleus of it is white supremacy. That's the nucleus of it. if we truly understood it to be so, then we would question a whole bunch of things, including educational policy. And we have enough information, there's enough evidence to suggest that despite the passage of all this time and all these declarations and all these various pieces of legislation passed and so forth, we remain pretty much in the same position with regard to the power equation in the country. There's a group that is ahead and will always be ahead. There's a group that's in charge and will always be in charge. There's a group that's oppressed. And so far, it has been consistent that these groups are oppressed, notwithstanding all this legislation. But there was also a time when these oppressed groups were smart enough to devise their own systems, education being one in the African-American community, absolutely. All oppressed people began their own institutions to serve the needs that were not being met. Every single ethnic group. The African-American community had schools that were doing very well, even up until the 50s. They were doing quite well, turning out great, great material. Something happened. And the increased dependency on the government. But the question is, if you increase your dependency on the government, how is it possible that you think you can decrease its impact on you? The question for education is that the African American community, the Latino community, poor white community, other ethnic groups who see it as being necessary to fashion their own responses to the evidence, the preponderance of evidence, that they are going to get screwed. So might as well be proactive and take charge of certain things yourself. I give you the example of the Amish community. People may say, well, these folks are stuck in the past. Well, they will disagree with you. They have their own standards as to what's important to them. And they take full charge of every aspect of life that pertains to their progress as they see it, their belief systems as they see it, their morals as they see them. They take full charge of it. They do not trust any outside form of power. They are self-contained, self-reliant, and self-directed. A simple thing like a telephone. They don't have telephones. People would say, well, that's a backward thing. What about emergencies? Well, the fact is, they live in such a way that help is easily accessible because they live together. Their view of a telephone is, the telephone discourages people from actually going to visit other people and having a chat. They prefer human face-to-face contact. The telephone, therefore, is viewed as a thing that would challenge that way of life. It will promote remoteness and isolation. They value communal life and contact and interaction. So the telephone has to go. They're not opposed to the telephone at all. They're opposed to telephone use in their homes. If in any case of emergency, they would easily access, the drive to a telephone booth or get in some way, use a telephone to contact whoever the authorities may be. But they have every aspect of life covered. They build their own houses. They farm their own land. They, you know, they're self-contained communities. And I think they're a fantastic example of a community that takes itself very, very seriously. Hello, Eric.
Hi.
Hello.
This is a great show. I've been listening this whole time. And an image came to mind. And the image is one of a giant casino. It's like a slot machine. We're putting in so much as a society, as a country, as citizens. And, you know, every once in a while we get something back. And I'm talking predominantly about the poorer people, the people that are struggling, the more ghetto communities. We put in so much. We work so hard. And we feed the system, this so-called education system. And, you know, just like a slot machine, you're sticking in your money, and once in a while you see somebody spring out and, you know, they win big or they win slightly something, and everybody's going for that instead of realizing that we're just losing on a massive level. We're losing. So, you know, this vision of all of these people sitting in a giant casino at slot machines and feeding it and feeding and feeding it. And, you know, it's like we become addicted.
And we're not that's a fantastic image that you just succeeded in conjuring up to my mind. It's a great metaphor, because here's what we have gotten. I see the African-American community. Dominate now in prison populations. We have generations that are lost, just plain lost.
Tragic.
Schools in our communities are, for a while, most, especially in the 60s, the whole issue of the big fight in New York and in Chicago and other areas about the community control of schools. When schools, it was revealed even by the union, the schools were like just a mill for employment rather than, you know, actively taking a role in guiding children's minds so that they would develop into fine human beings. That has never been the thrust of education. Not really. Not by the government-controlled boards of education and so forth. So what I'm saying, Eric, and I thank you for that imagery. That's a fantastic metaphor. That you, they say you pays your money, it takes your chances. Except that we're talking about children here, and we're talking about their futures, and we're talking about the historical memory that we're losing, and institutional responses that we ought to be having, as opposed to begging them, please, could you do this, as if we don't understand that with whatever it is that they're going to respond, the primary reason, the primary impetus is to preserve the status quo. Thank you, Eric, for calling. Well, this is the end of our program today. You allowed me to talk more than I intended to, but of course we will continue this discussion. I hope that we could now get into a very, very vigorous discussion about what is an alternative to the crisis in education we see today. You'll want to stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. And you can certainly continue the conversation at leadstories@gmail.com and on the Facebook page as well, with Utrice with Lead Stories. So thank you so much. For those of you celebrating Easter, happy Easter to you. And we'll see each other on Monday, and we'll be talking again. Thanks so much.